Hello, this is Atta Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, August 18th, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page, housing. TIF helps bring life downtown. Renovations boost Decatur apartments and living environment. And this article is by Donette Beckett, Decatur. Downtown Decatur is getting a makeover, one apartment at a time. The city of Decatur is trying to do downtown living, trying to create a living environment, said Ben Andreas. Ben Andreas, owner of Main Place Properties. But this is just the start of what we're doing throughout all of Decatur. Main Place Properties staff recently invited the community to take a look into the newest additions to downtown Decatur, which included a couple of renovated apartments located above Merchant Street. The renovations were part of a tax increment financing, or TIF, redevelopment project, which includes two Main Place Properties downtown residential apartment buildings. The first is the two apartments above Giggles Retail Store on Merchant Street. The second includes the renovation of 10 apartments above Flora Gems on the corner of East Main and Water Streets. This is to showcase what we can do, Andreas said, to see if we can expand what downtown living can look like. Plans for revitalizing downtown Decatur also include the 12-story Barnes Citizens Building being coordinated by a different developer. The planned 120-room boutique hotel will hold residential apartments, a restaurant, and coffee bar, conference and meeting spaces, and other amenities. Working and living in downtown Decatur has its appeal, Andreas said. We live in rural America, rural Illinois, he said. We don't have a lot of options like a bigger city. Within 3 days of getting the word out, both of the 1,400-square-foot apartments on Merchant Street were leased. We found the tenants through word of mouth, Andreas said. Main Place Properties leases and sells commercial properties as well as residential. New employees make new residents, the staff pointed out. A person with a brand new job not from this area came and connected us, Andreas said. One of the attractions of the Merchant Street apartment are the large windows looking out over the west side of Decatur. The view on the east side apartment has an exposed brick wall of the building across the alley. Rent for the west side apartment is $1,800. The east side rent is $1,500. Tenants in the two-unit apartment building on Merchant Street will use stairs to reach the living quarters. However, the Flora Gems building will have a refurbished elevator. The renovation of the apartments above Flora Gems are expected to begin in September. Tenants will hopefully be moving in by next summer. The work has already included the utilities, facade, roof, and all the boring stuff, Andreas said. Now we get to do the cosmetic beautification. All of the materials used in the apartments were purchased locally, the builder said. One Stop Home Center provided the countertops. Lighting was supplied by Dunker Electric Supply, flooring and paint was from the local Sherwin-Williams store, and Dick Van Dyke provided the appliances. And we got all of the lumber from Menards, said Michael McClanahan, general contractor. The Main Place maintenance crew included Kyle Geckner and Nestor Martinez, who put it all together, McClanahan said. The city adapted the central TIF district, said Zane Peterson, managing broker from Main Place Properties. That's what's enabled this project and the Flora Gems project. The core area of the central tax increment financing district generally includes everything from North Street to the south and Wagner Street to the north, between Fairview Avenue to the west and Main Street to the east. Another portion includes areas between Main Street to the west and the Canadian National Railroad tracks to the east, reaching as far north as Marietta Street and south as Decatur Street. The southwestern portion of the district includes Areas south of North Avenue as far as Sunset Avenue between the diagonal Norfolk Southern Railroad tracks that dissect Millikan University to the east and Haworth Avenue to the west. TIF districts are used by local governments to leverage future gains in property tax revenue to attract private investment to blighted areas in need of redevelopment. Any increase in property tax revenue gets diverted to the TIF into the TIF, meaning that taxing bodies do not see the benefit of the increased increment during the life of the district. In theory, these funds are to be directed to projects or initiatives that will improve the aesthetics, quality of life, and property values of an area. It gives an incentive to improve the property, Peterson said. The Main Place properties marked 20 years with the introduction of the Merchant Street apartments. This is phenomenal, Andreas said. I'm really excited to transform downtown Decatur. It's a large color photo here. Ribbon cutting attendees explore the two new Main Place properties apartments after renovations in downtown Decatur on Friday, August 14th. And they're standing in the kitchen area, and there's 8 people standing around chatting with each other. Joseph Russler Herald and Review Photo Credit. And Mayor Julie Moore Wolf, Main Place properties owner Ben Andreas, and Decatur Regional Chamber of Commerce President Miranda Rothruck celebrate the two new downtown Decatur apartments with a ribbon cutting on Friday, August 14th. Iran and Middle East, Tehran threatens to go on offensive. Strait of Hormuz is targeted amid stalled talks with Washington. This article is by Parisa Hafezi and Catherine Jackson, Reuters. Iran has decided to shift its policy from defensive to fully offensive due to the deadlock in efforts to agree to a permanent end to its war with the United States, a senior Iranian official told Reuters on Monday. Progress toward peace talks and a resumption of oil tanker traffic through the strategic Strait of Hormuz has ground to a halt, with no sign that the warring parties are moving toward ending the conflict that the U.S. and Israel launched on February 28th. Iranian entities must be prepared to escalate tensions in the Strait of Hormuz and wider region, as Iran will be ready to make decisions and take action on difficult decisions, the Iranian official said, adding that Tehran would conduct a timely and precise military attack to break the U.S. naval blockade if diplomacy failed. There was no immediate response to those comments from Washington, but President Donald Trump said in a phone interview with Fox News on Monday that Iran should put up the white flag of surrender. Throughout the conflict, Trump has alternated between threats of escalation and assertions that a peace deal is imminent. Monday marked the day by which Iran and the United States were expected to reach a final deal under a memorandum of understanding agreed in June and aimed at ending the war. Signed on June 17th, the MOU set out a 60-day time frame extendable by mutual consent by which Washington and Tehran should reach a broader agreement on issues including limiting Tehran's nuclear program and lifting U.S. sanctions. That interim deal, which declared the immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, quickly unraveled, however, due to a dispute over control of the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway through which a fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas flowed before the war. Tehran said point 5 of the MOU gave it the right to manage the strait, which it shares with Oman, while Washington rejected that interpretation. Hostilities resumed as Tehran began firing on vessels it said were trying to sail through the waterway on an unapproved route. Trump said on July 7th that the pact was over. Tehran has repeatedly accused Washington of consistently violating its commitments. Within the short period of a few weeks set by Iran, all the agreement's provisions must be implemented by the U.S. This is a precondition for a further negotiation with the U.S., the Iranian official told Reuters, adding that mediators would share Tehran's deadline with Washington and regional states. Tehran has separately agreed or been negotiating an agreement with Oman over management of the strait, seen as a key component of a wider deal, and says they are close to agreement, although progress has been slow. If Oman gets in the way, we'll bomb the S blank 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 out of them, Trump told Fox. There was no immediate comment from Oman. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict, mainly in Iran and Lebanon, since the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran at the end of February. Iran has struck U.S. assets and infrastructure in countries including Oman, Jordan, Kuwait, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Both Iran and the United States have stepped up rhetoric over the past week. Trump warned Americans in a speech at a rally on Friday to prepare for a continued high fuel prices as a result of the war, while also saying that after we finish defeating them pretty soon, I'll be declaring the Hormuz Strait a territory of the United States. Earlier on Monday, Trump posted on his Truth Social platform, "The number one goal is and always will be that Iran cannot have in any way, shape, or form a nuclear weapon," repeating one of his stated rationales for the war. Benchmark Brent crude oil futures LCOCL have surged since the start of the war in February, hitting a peak of $126 a barrel, roughly 75% above pre-war levels, with choppy trade reflecting concerns over disruptions to Gulf oil supplies and shifting signals on peace talks. Brent crude rose slightly on Monday to around $89 a barrel. Attacked by Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen have also renewed concerns about a widening regional war and the economic fallout it could bring. In the latest incident, the Houthis attacked what they called a Saudi military ship and four escort vessels in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait with missiles, according to the group's military spokesperson Yahya Sari on Telegram on Monday. The strait is a strategic choke point connecting the Red Sea with the Gulf of Aden and an important international shipping route. There was no immediate confirmation from Saudi authorities. Mississippi NAACP joins effort to probe teen's death. Bianca Flowers and Kat Stafford from Reuters have this article. Chicago, the NAACP announced Monday it has joined the legal team representing the family of Nolan Wells, an 18-year-old black teen whose body was found on a Mississippi barrier island last month after a 4th of July trip with three white friends. The U.S. Civil Rights Organization said its Office of General Counsel will work with the family's lawyers, including prominent civil rights attorney Ben Crump, to seek a comprehensive investigation and greater transparency from authorities into Wells' death. "We're taking up the fight to search for truth and transparency surrounding the death of Nolan Wells," Kristen Clark, general counsel of the NAACP, said in a statement. The NAACP's involvement underscores how Wells' death has evolved from a local investigation into a case drawing national scrutiny. Although authorities have not announced final findings or alleged foul play, questions raised by family members, civil rights leaders, and others about race, transparency, and accountability have fueled calls for greater scrutiny. Last week, the Congressional Black Caucus issued a letter to Attorney General Todd Blanche and FBI Director Kash Patel urging the U.S. Department of Justice to launch an independent federal review of Wells' death. The case has also prompted broader conversations among some black Americans about racism, safety in predominantly white spaces, and disparities in attention to cases involving black victims. Clark said the organization would bring additional investigative resources to ensure that no stone is left unturned in the Wells family's request for answers. Wells' body was found on July 6th on the northwestern end of Horn Island, a barrier island off the Mississippi Gulf Coast, after he went missing during a 4th of July weekend trip there with friends from nearby Ocean Springs, Mississippi. The Jackson County Sheriff's Office, which is leading the investigation, has said the case remains ongoing. Investigators have not publicly released final conclusions about how Wells died. Crump previously said the family was seeking answers about discrepancies in the accounts of Wells' final hours, including why his phone was found with one of the friends rather than with his body. He also cited unverified video circulating online that purportedly showed Wells arguing with friends before he vanished. An attorney for one of the friends could not be reached for comment. An independent autopsy commissioned by the family found that Wells' manner of death remained undetermined. The results were announced at the organization's 117th National Convention in Chicago last month. The NAACP has long intervened in cases that drew national attention, helping push for investigations, legal action, and public accountability in matters ranging from the brutal 1955 killing of Emmett Till to recent high-profile incidents involving Black Americans whose deaths prompted calls for answers. The world is watching, and Nolan Wells' family deserves a thorough accounting of what happened, NAACP President and CEO Derek Johnson said in the statement. Our involvement in this case is part of our ongoing commitment to make sure those answers are pursued with urgency and respect for Black lives. Moving on to the state and nation. From the State House, Rich Miller. After Michael J. Madigan's 36 years as Illinois House Speaker, a 10-year term limit on current and future speakers doesn't seem like a lot of time in the big chair. Except it is. Nobody, prior to Madigan, had ever served 10 years as Speaker in this state, going back to when Illinois became a state in 1818. The only person who came close was Republican Warren Wood, who held the position for 8 years in the 1950s. Most of the rest served single terms or two terms. Democrat Paul Powell served 6 years, including 2 years before Speaker Wood, and 4 years after. Powell became infamous for stashing cash in shoeboxes at his Springfield hotel residence and died with an estimated fortune of $4.6 million. But I digress. Another Democrat, Bill Redmond, also held the gavel for 6 years, although the future Speaker Madigan held quite a bit of sway over him in the late 1970s. Two Republicans served as Speaker for 6 years each in the early 1900s, but that's about it. Republican George Ryan was Speaker for 2 years before he was tapped to be Governor Jim Thompson's running mate. In the 1930s, four different members, three Democrats and one Republican, held the gavel for just 2 years each. 47 out of 70 House Speakers served 2 years or less, 4 days in the case of Ryan's Majority Leader Art Telkser. What I'm getting at is 10 years is actually a long time. More importantly, though, the 10-year ceiling also has somehow become a floor, an expected decade-long entitlement. House Speaker Chris Welch has obviously fully intended to serve the full decade since he was first elected to the chamber's top job for a 2-year term in 2021. You may have noticed that a couple of his members, who spoke out early about his mishandling of the Harry Benton sexual harassment matter, suddenly went silent. That was no coincidence. Pressure is being exerted on the rank and file. His team wants those 10 years. But a decade with the gavel is not only historically unique, it's also longer than the average service time for House Democratic members, which is currently less than 8.5 years. That's up a bit from a 6-year average in 2020, according to the State House's unofficial honorary historian, a title I just made up, John Amdor, but it's still below the 10-year House Speaker term limit. Starting in the final two decades of the previous century, the Senate has a history of electing Senate presidents to multiple terms. Democrat Phil Rock held the Senate's gavel for 14 years. Then Republican Pate Phillips served 10 years before the Democrats won the right to draw the new district map in 2001. Democrat Emil Jones was the chamber's top person for 6 years and was replaced by Democrat John Cullerton for 11 years. Current Senate President Don Harmon was first elected in 2020, but he's eligible to serve until 2031 because that first year after Cullerton resigned midterm doesn't count toward the chamber's 10-year term limit. Before Rock, most Senate presidents served just 2 to 6 years, except for the 10 years that Republican Senator Art Bidwell held the gavel from 1955 to 1965. One of the reasons House Speakers and Senate presidents served such short stints was that party dominance wasn't assured like it has been for the past several decades. Partisan majorities flipped back and forth, much more before the advent of computer-driven redistricting. Republicans and downstate Democrats would also occasionally scheme to prevent Chicago from holding power in their chambers, which is how Powell was first elected Speaker. I'm not advocating here for reducing the term limits to 6 years or whatever, but what I am saying is that Illinois government will not crash and burn if Speaker Welch and the Senate President Harmon don't serve their full 5 2-year general assemblies as their chamber's leaders. They should both have to earn each and every one of their 2-year terms. A 10-year stint should not be considered the minimum length of service. If their members want both of them to stick around, that's their decision, as long as they recognize that nobody is automatically entitled to a decade at the top. Rich Miller publishes Capital Facts, a daily political newsletter, and capitalfacts.com. Local and Nation, Decatur Public Schools, new school year starts with new leaders. Articles by Valerie Wells, Decatur. You might notice some new faces in Decatur Public Schools this year. The summer was busy with changes in personnel, and several new administrators are in place. Nicole Nash Moody, superintendent formerly of Springfield Public Schools. Nicole Khoury Malson, assistant superintendent of teaching and learning formerly of Peoria Public Schools. Thomas Osborne, chief operations officer formerly of Sylacauga Schools, Sylacauga, Alabama. Gianna Outerbridge, principal, Dennis Lab School, formerly of Champaign Unit 4 School District. Orlando Thomas, principal, Johns Hill Magnet School, formerly of Champaign Unit 4 School District. Lasonia Reed, assistant principal, Dennis Lab School, formerly of Champaign Unit 4 School District. And Rochelle Douglas, assistant principal, Johns Hill Magnet School, formerly of Jefferson County Schools, Kentucky. The district also has promoted some staff members into new leadership positions. Jessica Meyer, assistant principal, Eisenhower High School, formerly third grade teacher at Muffley School. Libby Kirkland, assistant principal, Johns Hill Magnet School, formerly second grade teacher at Muffley. And Julie Turner, assistant principal, Baum School, formerly teaching and learning strategist at the Professional Development Institute. Very interesting article here in The Nation, U.S. History, Digging into a Theory. Crew plans to excavate object on remote isle in search of Earhart plane. Christopher Kahn, USA Today. What happened to Amelia Earhart? That question eluded countless researchers, biographers, and devoted enthusiasts for almost 90 years. Researchers scanned swaths of the ocean floor, traversed remote islands, and scoured satellite images in efforts to locate the plane that Earhart piloted as she sought to become the first person to fly around the world, or fly around the world along the equator. Now an expedition that some believe represents the best chance at solving the mystery is set to take place this fall. Unsolved disappearance. Earhart and Noonan disappeared July 2, 1937, as they flew from Ley, Papua New Guinea, toward Howland Island, where the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Itasca waited with refueling supplies. The pair were near the end of their round-the-world journey that began May 21, 1937, in Oakland, California. Coast Guard authorities received voice messages from Earhart, who warned that she was almost out of fuel. Neither Earhart nor Noonan knew Morse code, so there was no two-way contact, according to the Smithsonian Institute's analysis of government records. "I'm feeling very confident about this," lead archaeologist Richard Pettigrew said. "I'm pumped." In October, a 16-person team of researchers will head to Nikumaroro, a remote Pacific island where a popular theory suggests Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, landed in 1937. The expedition centers around the Taraya object, an anomaly spotted in the ocean's or the island's lagoon. The mission, a joint effort between the Purdue Research Foundation and the Archaeology Legacy Institute, aims to determine if the object is Earhart's long-lost plane. After their disappearance, the U.S. government conducted its largest ever search for a lost aircraft. After 2 weeks, the search ended with no trace of Earhart, Noonan, or their plane. On January 5, 1939, they were declared legally dead. Since then, millions of dollars are poured into research expeditions seeking answers. In 2024, an ocean expedition company conducted a deep-sea search within 100 miles of Howland Island after spotting what was believed to be the wreckage of the Electra 10E. It turned out to be a rock formation. Hypotheses unproven. Earhart's disappearance sparked wide range of theories. Some posit that the flight was part of a secret spy mission, that Earhart assumed another identity, or that she and Noonan were captured by the Japanese. The most widely supported explanation is that Earhart and Noonan ran out of fuel and crashed into the Pacific Ocean near Howland Island. "I do believe that they were close to Howland Island based on the records," said Dorothy Cochran, a retired general aviation curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and a leading expert on Amelia Earhart. A hypothesis that Earhart and Noonan landed on Nikumaroro and died there gained steam in recent years. The main piece of evidence is a satellite imagery of the item in the island's lagoon. Pettigrew said the object came into view in April 2015 and resembles an anomaly seen in photographs taken in the months and years after Earhart's disappearance. Other supporting evidence includes radio bearings that converge on Nikumararo and analysis of human bones discovered on the island that are similar to Earhart's bone links and artifacts, including a woman's shoe, a freckle cream jar, and a medicine vial that date back to the 1930s, according to the Purdue Research Foundation. In October, researchers are set to travel by ship to Nikumararo using a hydraulic dredge. A crew will gently remove sediment to determine if the object in the lagoon is the Electra 10E. If it is the aircraft, then the team will return next year for a full-scale excavation, Pettigrew said. Crews eventually would transport the wreckage back to the United States. Steve Schultz, senior vice president of Purdue University, said the institution is in discussions with the government of Kiribati, the island nation that controls Nikumararo, over a potential agreement that would entrust Purdue with the wreckage. Earhart, once a visiting advisor and counselor at Purdue, intended to give the plane to the university after her historic flight so it could be used for scientific research in aeronautics, according to Purdue's Research Foundation. That would be our vision, Schultz said, to fulfill Amelia's wishes and bring it back to Purdue on a permanent display for the world to see. Cochrane and other researchers remain skeptical. It would be amazing if they do find something, said Rachel Hartigan, who authored a book about Earhart and twice traveled to Nikumararo as a journalist covering expeditions. But there's just been a lot of promising things that haven't come through. And there is a medium-sized black and white photo here, probably one of the more famous ones here, of Amelia Earhart sits inside an airplane in 1936, Library of Congress. It's the Hammond Y, Department of Commerce, Bureau of Air Commerce, and her hand is holding the door open, and she's looking straight at the camera. And let's see here. There's a map, a small map, showing Nikumararo off the northeast coast of Australia, way out there in the Pacific Ocean. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, August 18th, 2026. We'll take a short break here and return with the second half hour.